Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give and there's no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off and every now and then or once every time you listen. It's up to you. Click on the supporter link that you can find in the episode or show description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your payment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, everybody. My name is Malcolm Haynes. I live in Bristol, and I'm very happy to be part of the House Culture podcast.
House Culture.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special episode of the House Culture podcast, hosted by me, the managing editor at House Culture, Matt Rouse. Welcome to the podcast. If you've not been here before, hello from House Culture, a collective of house music fans who have come together through their mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. Our home on Instagram at houseculturenet is where the party happens, but if you want to dig a little deeper, you can listen to us chat to genuine house music royalty in our previous podcast episodes that have featured the likes of Norman Cook, David Morales, Danny Tenaglia, Tall Paul and Danny Rampling. But our conversations don't just stop there. As we are House Culture, we like to investigate every element of this scene. And that is why we have also spoken to people like Manumission founding member and Pikes Hotel creative director Dawn Hindle, saxophone sensation Lovely Laura, Kiss FM founder Gordon Mack, and ex-Hacienda regular Buckley. Honestly, if you don't recognise the name, have a listen, as we handpick all of our guests to make sure they have a fascinating story to tell. Now that summer has well and truly arrived, you're not missing the festival vibes too much. I know we're all counting down the days until we can gather in a sun-kissed field sometime soon, but in the meantime, this special episode should tide you over until we can all do so again. Because in celebration of what would have been the 2021 Glastonbury Festival weekend, we caught up with a man who, over a nearly 30-year career working for the festival, became one of the major faces backstage at Worthy Farm. His name is, of course, Malcolm Haynes, and if that's one that you're not familiar with, if you've ever been lucky enough to have attended Glastonbury, you'll most certainly have partied to some of Malcolm's programming, as he is the person widely credited with introducing dance music to the festival, and was the head honcho of the Dance Tent, later the Dance Village, and more recently the huge spectacle now known as Silver Haze. His career at Glastonbury saw him working with a who's who of the dance music community, and as you'll hear in this episode, he is full of many stories about the behind the scenes goings on at the world's biggest festival, including his memories of his first ever Glastonbury experience.
I went to a festival when I was 10 years old, and all I remember was naked people dancing. And I just remember it was just quite bizarre. So I think my first Glastonbury experience was when I was 10 years old.
The time he turned up at the festival with his own sound system.
Literally, I just drove my truck in front of the second stage, and we just had a rave. And we did it for 2 nights, and it was fantastic. It was amazing. So that was my first official, unofficial introduction to Glastonbury, and there must have been 3,000 people there.
The legendary act that he's most proud to have booked.
That's my favourite part of Glastonbury, and Daft Punk has only ever played there once. It was amazing. Every time the bass dropped in. It was like England scoring a goal. I could actually feel the roar in my stomach. It's the most incredible experience of my life.
And the reasons why he puts on gigs in the first place.
There is no better feeling than whether the venue's packed or whether there's very few people there, but just looking at people and seeing, are they enjoying what they're seeing? And I've promoted all my life. I've probably lost as much as I made, but I think I can honestly say that I put good gigs on.
So I hope you've got your tent packed and your wellies on your feet, as we're about to take a trip to the most iconic music festival in the world, Glastonbury. Here's our guide, Malcolm Haynes.
House Culture.
Hi, Malcolm. Thanks for sitting down with us on the House Culture podcast today to share the incredible journey you've had throughout your career. You are widely credited as the man that brought dance music to Glastonbury, and as part of that, you basically booked anyone who is anyone within the electronic music scene. However, before we dig into that, we always want to start at the beginning. Can you tell us where you grew up and how you first discovered a love for music?
I was brought up in care. I was literally snatched from home when I was about 6 months old. So I've never lived with my parents throughout my whole life. When I was about seven, I got into music, and I used to have a little transistor radio that I used to put under my pillow, and I wasn't allowed to have that radio. So it was very, I was being very naughty, even at the age of 7 or 8 years old. And I used to listen to Radio Luxembourg, mm-hmm. which is a pirate radio station that was based out in the channel, and used to listen to so many. Robbie Vincent used to be on there, I think, and also I remember there was a DJ called Roscoe. He mm-hmm. was like, yeah, he was like my idol at that time. So I got into music very young, and it was, for me, something that replaced the disattachment that I had as a child growing up in a children's home. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's why music became my saviour.
I think for a lot of us as well, yeah. And it's a very similar journey. A lot of the people that we've spoken to as well, having a radio under their pillow at night and, you know, discovering all of this new music, it's kind of illicit in some way.
The thing is, Matt, if I would have got caught, I would have like had sanctioned for like a week, or even some places actually being locked into a padded room because I've been naughty.
No way.
So that was the risk I was taking. Yeah, I wasn't allowed to not just listen to a radio, but have a transistor radio. It just wasn't allowed.
Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, do you think having such that indelible, that risk, do you think that's what drove you a little bit looking back into the music scene?
I don't know. I think as an adult now, you can only look back on your childhood and reflect on what shaped you as a child growing up. And when you grow up as a child, you have nothing to base your childhood on. So you don't look at your neighbor next door and say, oh, that child's having a better life than me. Yeah, because you just don't comprehend those sorts of things. So what I did as a child, and when I say a child, I think anywhere between the age of nil and 11 years old, I think you're still a child then. Music came into my life. But also at the same time, I was really inquisitive. So I got into electronic as well. You used to be able to buy these magazines called Electronic Weekly or whatever, and it taught you how to build amplifiers and taught you just simple things like, you know, what a diode does, what a capacitor does, what a resistor does. So I got to really understand how, because this, we're talking about the 70s, I suppose, or sort of late 60s, early 70s. So we're talking about sort of how electronic became much more advanced. And so I learned how to build amplifiers from components that I could buy online. Mm-hmm. You know, so I was in these children's homes, and I'd be, you know, the staff would say, what are you doing? I thought, oh, just working on something. You know, the kids are going, what are you doing? I go, wait and see, you know. And then suddenly in the community room where we had the table tennis and the snooker, you know, I'd suddenly like set everything up and just blast out loads of music. And then we go, what the fuck's going on here? You know? And I used to take TVs apart. Mm-hmm. Literally up to the age of 9, 10, had a screwdriver or a knife, and I had my hand in the sight in the back of TVs, and I blew myself across the room quite a few times. quite a few times, literally. And I can honestly say that, yes, if you get an electric shock, it can blow you across the room. I did that as a young age. Yeah. So I was banned from going anywhere within 3 meters of any electrical appliance. And I was like 12 years old.
Yeah. And I mean, do you think that that love for electronics kind of bled through into the electronic music scene and the music? Did that give you an extra inquisitiveness into how people were making this type of music when that started to become more prevalent in the 80s?
Interesting question. Growing up, I played around with the guitar, I played around with the piano, and I couldn't read music, but I could learn chords and sort of play what I thought I could hear. I don't know. Yes, in some ways, being fascinated by technology. Yeah, I remember like growing up with gramophones and valves, you know, and going down to my mum's local shop, the record shop, and we'd buy a new valve for the gramophone because it had gone. So from going from valves to that whole sort of transistor technology, I was very interested in that, of course. It was something I found fascinating. I was also into maths at that time. I loved crosswords. And the music, I didn't see a connection. I really didn't see a connection between what I was listening to as a child growing up and what I was doing as a child, designing amplifiers and building things from electronics. For me, it was just like to be able to play it as loud as possible. I need this particular transistor or this particular capacitor, and that's going to take me like 2 weeks pocket money to get that. But literally, I built my own circuit boards, had my own soldering irons, little screwdrivers, and I was that little child scientist, I suppose.
Wow. And like, so how did that develop then into kind of what you first started to do? I mean, researching this podcast, it's my understanding that you started working for Glastonbury, booking Jazz World, and that was after a first visit to Glastonbury in 1989. Tell us about that story.
I remember, I'm sure, really thought about this. I went to a festival when I was 10 years old, and all I remember was naked people dancing. And that's all I can remember. And there's only one or two events that could possibly have been. Mm-hmm. It could have either been Stonehenge or it could have been the first Glastonbury.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
I cannot remember the pyramids, but the more I think about it and the more I try to remember, I think it was Glastonbury. I happened to be in a children's home at that particular time, and the staff were casual workers, as they still are. But it was a hippie era, and I remember them taking all of us to this festival. So I think that was Glastonbury Festival, or it could have been Stonehenge. Mm. And I just remember it was just quite bizarre. So I think my first Glastonbury experience was when I was 10 years old. Yes, I think I might have gone back there when I was 17, 77. That was in the days when, literally on a Saturday afternoon, you say to your mates, oh, should we go to Glastonbury? Yeah. Okay. And you just get in your car, and you drive down there, and you just walk around the perimeter fence, and you find a way to get in. Mm-hmm. And that was it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean, and there probably wasn't even a perimeter fence at that time.
Yeah.
It was beautiful. It was lovely. It was like, and for me, being only like, late teens, it was a real eye-opener and very lovely. So that's my first experience as a Glastonbury. Mm-hmm. When I really started working at Glastonbury was probably 87. I used to work in Bristol at a pub, at a bar, and I was promoting as well. Mm-hmm. I was doing other things outside the bar. But there was this guy who used to come in, drop off this magazine called the Venue Magazine, and he did it every week. And I kind of knew him, he knew me, and it was a great magazine. It was all about Bristol. It was all about music, live music, what's going on. It was like the original What's On magazine, what's going on in Bristol. And it took me a while. And then I realized that, oh, this is the guy who books the second stage at Glastonbury. Not the Jazz World, but he actually books the second stage. Mm-hmm. And I just got chatting to him, and he said, oh, yeah, come on down. Why are you coming down, DJ? Because I was also DJing as well outside my bar work, and also promoting in Bristol at the same time, and had been for many years. And when I got there, I realized that he had invited every other DJ in Bristol to DJ on that stage. And it was only about DJing in between the bands at that stage. I mean, there was never sort of the DJ is the set. Mm-hmm. wasn't really there. It was still very much about live music, you know?
Yeah.
And it so happened that I had my own PA at the time. You know, it's only about 4,000 watts, but I would do local gigs. So I knew a lot about engineering. I would set up the live music. And when I promoted in the smaller clubs in Bristol, I would use my own PA because it obviously saved me loads of money. Mm-hmm. And so I got there and then there was clearly no opportunity to DJ in between the bands because every other up and coming great DJs were playing, you know, and I'm sure I can think of some of the names later. And so on the Friday night, it was funny, on the Friday night, I just like thought, hang about, you know, I got my van here. The reason I got my van because I could sleep in it, you know, put a mattress in the back. But also, like, hang on, I've got a PA, I've got a generator, I've got decks, I've got everything here, you know. So I did ask Mark because the stage shut at 12 o'clock. And we're talking about the second stage here.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be equivalent to the enemy stage now.
Yes, yeah.
You know, and I just said, look, can I just like set up for a few hours? And he said, I've got no power. I went, oh, I can sort myself out. And so literally I just drove my truck in front of the second stage and we just like set it up and we just had a rave. And we did that on the Friday and the Saturday. And on the first night, I remember, bless his soul, lovely guy from Bristol. And I only knew as Indian Paul. Mm. He worked in all the clubs, you know, all the coolest clubs. He was there. No one fucked with him. Do you know what I mean? It was Indian Paul.
Yeah.
And I remember he was like looking after the security at that time on that area. And I remember on the Friday, he came rushing over to me going, whoa, what the? And he looked at me and went, oh, it's you. I went, yeah, it's cool. And then, yeah, I had like John Stapleton. I had like loads of great DJs from Bristol at the Assembly. And we did it for two nights and it was fantastic. It was amazing. So that was my first official, unofficial introduction to Glastonbury. And just to finish off on that story as well, when it came to the Sunday, when we were told that we couldn't do it again, you know. But I also knew the PA company on that stage and I had a chat with them and I knew that it would take them at least an hour and a half to unpack everything. So I said, look, can I just set my decked up on the stage, literally on a riser, and just played into it. And we did the same thing on the Sunday.
Wow.
And that was like, there must have been 3,000 people there. So that was my introduction to Glastonbury.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about that weekend, when I went there, I realized that I'd say 3/4 of the lineup on that stage that weekend was all the bands that I was and am working with in Bristol. So I was like, oh, hang about. This guy at Glastonbury is booking the bands that I've been working with. And so I just said to him, look, I'd love to come back next year and get involved and, you know, help you book the stage because 3/4 of the stage you got is the stuff that I work with anyway. And I was like, only 27. And that was fine. And then what happened the following year, my good friend Martin Alborn, got involved with Glastonbury Festival and he introduced the NME to Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And so the second stage then became the NME stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like Mark didn't have a stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember talking to him in the preceding year up to the next festival because I was like, I was really keen there. I was like, wow, fucking hell. This guy is running the stage at Glastonbury and like, it's my fucking lineup. You know what I mean? It's like, what are you doing? Copying me? And I realized that he was and copying a lot of other people, you know? And so we didn't have a stage. And then, you know, Michael said, oh, maybe. And I think Mark Simmons, and I pay ultimate respect to Mark Simmons because without Mark Simmons, I would not have ever got involved with Glastonbury, I think. So, but that's another story. But I do have ultimate respect for Mark. So Michael suggested having a jazz stage, you know, and so I got, that was my real proper involvement with Glastonbury.
Yeah.
I was kind of official, I was known, you know, I met Michael, met Jean at that time, you know, sadly she passed away a few years later, but lovely, amazing Yeah, I have a lot of history with Glastonbury. So, yes, so I got involved with Glastonbury, I think it was 87. It might have been the first year of the Jazz World Stage. And I remember that we had Galliano was our headline act. So we're in that whole Talking Loud, you know, era. If you look at the records as well, it's kind of, you know, street, what was it? Streetwise or?
Street Sounds.
Street Sounds, yeah. There's a guy called Ali who ran it, didn't he? Amazing guy. I met him quite a few times and I really admired his, just his enthusiasm for music. And it's funny because what he did, he just reintroduced the music that we were all listening to 15 years before, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
I started DJing when I was 13. Sorry, I would like to just, I think this is really important. Yeah. This is very important in my life. Yes, one was the music, yes. And two was the fact that I was brought up in care. Didn't mean that my parents fucked me up. The system fucked me up. And I got locked up in a detention center when I was 9 years old. Not because I'd done anything criminal, but because I'd been expelled from so many schools in Bristol that no school or no children's home would take me. So they locked me up for 6 weeks. So that's spending 13 years in care, right? Being moved every 18 months on average. Different social worker, different school, different set of circumstances, different home. The authorities thought that I would be really good. It would be good to send him home to his mother, who I have never spent more than one night in my whole life between the age of nil and one with her. Which is, and the home life was very chaotic. I'm the youngest of seven. All of us were put into care. So they sent me home. They sent me home at the start of the summer holidays in 73. And the local fairground, was there. It was in Hartcliffe in Bristol. And I went and worked on the fairground, knowing that in 6 weeks' time, I would have to join the local comprehensive school, you know, but I joined the fair and I went and worked there and it was there for 2 weeks and they left and I left with them. I ran away with them.
You ran away with the fair.
And it took like 6 months for the authorities and the police to catch up with me. And ironically, they caught up with me at Glastonbury Fair. And that's where social services and the police came and picked me up and took me back to the home. The reason I say this is really important is because despite like it took them 6 weeks, whatever, to find me and catch up with me, and I was only 13, I was given a bed, I was fed, I was given a purpose. And for me, it was like that was an attachment. So when they took me back to the children's homes, I stayed in contact with the fair. So living in an institution, instead of going home at all the school holidays, they would pick me up, the fair people, David and Carolyn, much respect to them. They're the closest thing to my parents. They would arrange to pick me up and take me to the fair, and I would work on the fair with them, and then they'd drop me back off, and I'd come back with a wad of money, you know, because like, what are you doing for the school holidays? I went and worked on the fair. I got like, But when I was 15, it was clear that I wasn't going to go back and live with my mum. David and Carol from the fair, they offered to be my guardians. So they became my guardians. They went to court when I was 15 years old and they became my guardians. And I went to live on the fairground. And I lived on the fairground full time, traveled around with the fair until I was 18 years old. And at that time, I was promoted within the fair thing, you know, so that I had my own machine. You know, it was a Cyclone Twist, and I would be responsible for that machine. So I would like check the safety of it every day, clean it, make sure it's maintained. But also, I'd sit in the pay box with the microphone playing the music. David and Carol, they could never understand why I was always the last fairground machine to close at the end of the night, because there would just be loads of people around, and I'd say, it's the music. And so they would give me money. So they would say, oh, here's £20, go and buy some records. So I would go to the record shop wherever I was, traveling all over the country. I knew the American imports because I was reading blues and soul. I was reading black music at that time. So I knew what was, I was already into Roy Ayres, I was already into Bob Marley, you know. So part of, when I say that music saved my life, David and Carol Wynn also saved my life. and they gave me that attachment, that grounding, and they caught me at the right time.
Yeah,
I could easily have gone down a road of being locked up all my life, being a fucking junkie, being a criminal. I have lots of stories also that helped me decide in my own mind that this is not what I want to do. Yeah. I might have been brought up in care. I might have been written off by a psychiatrist when I'm fucking 2 years old. I proved you all
wrong. Yeah, you did prove them all wrong. And how great to have that moment at, like you say, at the right time at such a young age, because sometimes those moments can't or don't happen until, you know, you're a bit further down that path that there's no return from. And so being in the booth and playing these records to an audience and whatever, that's what gave you a taste for performing and getting into music and traveling around. It all sounds like to me, when you look back on it, it's all come together.
No, it did. Honestly, like, God, I must have been like 16, and I'm in the pay box with my record deck, which would be on springs because the machine's going like this, so I need to get the record straight. And I've got a microphone, and I know it sounds corny now, but you know, all right, you want to stay in that car, hold on to that bar, the louder you scream, the faster you go. It was all that. Even before that, I was doing private parties for families and friends. And it was back in the day when the DJ talked.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? The DJ talked in between the tunes, you know, or played a couple of tunes and didn't say anything, you know. I used to DJ in a nightclub. So my older sister, she was also brought up in care.
Mm-hmm.
But she, when I was 13, she was like 18, 19, she was being a nurse and working a lot. And also loving music, working in a nightclub. She took me to my first nightclub, which was the Dugout in Bristol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was 13 years old. I borrowed my older brother's overcoat, Matt, to look older. And I just sat in the kitchen all night helping her do burgers. But anyway, she used to go out with one of Rolls Royce,
mm-hmm.
you know, like car wash, yeah. Very famous in the 70s and 80s. And she was going out with a guy called Trey Stone. Rolls Royce were playing in Bristol, and Della, my sister, wanted to organize an after show party for them. And she went to quite a famous club on the Triangle in Bristol called Vadim's, run by basically gangsters. So they said, yeah, you can have a party. And so my sister said, I want my kid brother to play,
mm-hmm.
you know? And they were like, no, it's either my kid brother plays or the party doesn't happen. Anyway, I played, the pub was packed, you know, and I just played this amazing jazz funk and, you know, that it was our whole era.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a job. At that time, I was working in a supermarket warehouse earning, I don't know, £75 a week.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly after that party, the nightclub owner came up to me and said, you know, I'll pay you £170 a week. 18, 19 years old. I'm like, yeah, go for that. So that's another story how I got into DJing more.
Yeah.
But I was always, I was always just a party DJ. I was just like a friend of the family, you know, who had, I had some decks, mm-hmm. you know, I had a couple of little boxes of records at that time. And I knew how to play, you know, I was like collecting the popular music.
Yeah.
Mainly black music mm-hmm. at that time. That was another thing I did. Yeah.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Cool. I mean, so, you know, you were, by the time you did rock up at Glastonbury with your sound system and whatever, and, you know, you're playing to, putting on mini raves to 3,000 people kind of semi-legally on the site, you're already, you know, got the fairground patter behind the mic and the skills behind the decks. I mean, you know, starting on the jazz world side of things, the dance tent began in 1995. I mean, obviously that's a 5-year difference.
There's a story behind it.
Yeah, so how did this idea grow?
Okay, so we started the jazz world stage. I was working alongside Mark Simmons, mm-hmm. Mainly doing all the programming. So talking to the agents, talking to the managers, and we delivered the Jazz World Stage for 5 years. I remember at that time, Michael never knew where to put us. So like we literally moved every year. The Jazz Stage was in the, it was called Jazz Stage the first couple of years, and then it went to Jazz World. Mm-hmm. But every year it moved into a different place. And then probably after 5 years or so, we managed to persuade Michael to let us have a workshop tent. This must have been, what, I don't know, 91 maybe. So we were running this for a few years. And then 1 year I booked this PA, this sound system from the Midlands. I'm not going to mention their name because you did fuck me over. but they were like the unofficial after show, unofficial tents. Well, it's like we got the backstage. But then they played all night. They played all fucking night. And I asked them to switch off and they wouldn't switch off. Mm-hmm. I did later switch people off, but at that time I didn't. I remember Arabella Churchill, very good friend of Michael Eavis and runs a circus and theatre. Mm-hmm. You know, she came out early in the morning shouting at me. And yeah, I felt completely powerless. Anyway, that happened. It turned out that Michael got fined for that incident. Mm. You know, he got fined by the council for overreach of the license. Mm-hmm. Well, I can say this. Mark blamed me. Mm-hmm. I made the booking. And fair enough, I did make the booking. But I don't see it as all my fault. So I remember going on holiday in January for a couple of weeks to Spain and coming back. And I just wanted to see Michael. Can't remember what I went to see him about. Just because something felt uneasy. And he kind of said, well, this happened. I got fined. And, you know, I know Mark. I've worked with Mark for like, you know, 15 years or whatever. And I don't know who you are. And basically, I didn't have a job. Yeah. That was it. It was like after sort of 5 years working with Jazz World, I was suddenly, you know, not there. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, we just started talking about other things. And then we started talking about dance music. And he was saying, oh, do you think we should have a dance tent? I said, well, that'd be a really good idea, Michael. You know, that'd be a great idea. And I know that he was being seduced by some of the big clubs at that time, mm-hmm. about doing something. And he sort of said to me, well, he said, do you know Massive Attack? Yeah, I kind of know them. Do you know Portishead? Yeah, I kind of know them as well. Well, why don't we have a dance tent and let's get them on? Well, why don't you have a chat to the guys who run the acoustic tent just to get, you know, just get an idea of how I run things. And that was it. That was the brief, you know. So I went off and talked to Massive Attack, and it turned out that Massive Attack didn't want a feature. If anything, they wanted to have their whole day. So that was fine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can give them their whole day. But it turned out that Portishead and Massive Attack wouldn't play in the same tent.
No way. Interesting.
I've heard lots of rumors why that was the case, but that was the situation. Mm-hmm. So it turned out on that year, 95, Portishead played in the acoustic tent and Massive Attack played in the dance tent.
Wow. So what was the battle there? Was there a winner and a loser, do you think? Or did someone make a call in terms of who played where? Or was it just a case of, you know, you spoke to Massive Attack first maybe and they got the dance tent?
I've got to be careful here because I respect both bands. Mm-hmm. And it was very early in their careers. Certainly, I remember that Massive Attack, you know, when the Gulf War kicked off, they had to drop the attack and they just went with Massive, mm-hmm. you know. And yeah, clearly any band in their development, that's a big thing for them. Mm-hmm. I just think, like, I put it down to, like, strong management on both sides, mm-hmm. yeah. And the management on both sides wanted the best result for their invitation to come and play the festival.
Yeah.
And with hindsight, looking back on it now, yeah, it worked for both. Yeah. You know, Portishead were not going to do it all day. Portishead were going to come and do a fucking amazing set.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Massive Attack, they're geared up because they're DJs, you know, they're street, and they look at a whole program, you mm-hmm. know what I mean? A whole vibe that they want for that day. And that's what they wanted. They wanted to decorate the tent. They wanted, you know, they wanted complete control mm-hmm. over what they did. And maybe management felt that, okay, that's great. You know, two bands in Bristol or Portishead in Bristol or whatever. Mm-hmm. And maybe it wasn't right for them to, like, be sort of hooked in into the same bag.
Yeah.
And I think with hindsight, I think it was a good move, actually. Yeah. I think it was okay. I mean, don't get me wrong, it was fraught with complications on the day, which I don't really want to go into, you know, but that was the first year of the dance tent.
Yeah.
I remember I think we had Club Dog involved as well at that particular time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, my memory is quite vague. I don't have any notes on previous glasses in front of me. So next question.
That's often the best way. I mean, I suppose, like, not specifically about 95, but I suppose more in kind of general about the dance tent and that arrival of that at Glastonbury. You know, historically, obviously, it was always a guitar rock music type, like live music type festival in that way, you know, not towards the electronic scene. What did you find in those first nascent years of that there was perhaps a resistance from the audience towards this, or were people engaging with it and really just giving it a fair crack?
I think it was a little bit of a surprise for me with regards to how popular dance music was. I'm not a raver. Mm-hmm. You know, I never went to, you know, raves, and I never took E, you know, so I'm not into that whole rave culture, which was, like, very big and coming up at that time. I was very much, I love live music. I still do. But I also do appreciate DJs. But even at that time, I was like, I had a conflict between, like, well, why am I paying you as much as I am for a band of seven people,
mm-hmm.
you know? And yeah, I understand market forces and all that business. But if you look at the dance tent, because we had, like, three berths within that area, dance tent, dance village, Silver Haze, mm-hmm. You can see that I was very much geared towards live music, even if it was electronic live music, mm-hmm. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I just felt I wanted to see the musicians playing the music instead of just pushing buttons.
Yeah.
And also, you know, saying that, people do, you know, they say, Malcolm, you know, you start to dance, and, you know, Glastonbury, that's quite an achievement. But then I say, well, look, and I admit this, it was just being in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
Having that conversation with Michael at that time inspired him to something that I'm sure he had been thinking about. But, you know, just asked me the question. Yeah, I can do that. And I also did Michael's wedding when he got married to Liz. You know, I organized his wedding on his front garden, mm-hmm. Which is a beautiful day. And also did Emily Eves' 21st birthday party in her back garden.
Wow.
That's Worthy Farm, which was, the theme was, Emily wanted the theme of Queen of the Desert.
Oh, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert?
Yes. I think so. So we all had to be sort of, you know, deserty. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember dressing up as a sheik and DJing. And, so my relationship with the family at Glastonbury is very close. Mm-hmm. So going back to, I was into live music more than I was into DJs. And obviously, as we progressed, what I found was after a few years that I wasn't able to portray all the different genres of dance music. Mm-hmm. It was vast. It was all these different, I couldn't keep up with the genres, I went back to Michael, I can't remember what year it was, maybe 2008 or 9, and said, look, we can't represent all the different genres of dance music with one tent. Mm-hmm. And also in that history of the dance tent, from 1995 to 99, whatever, we grew every year.
Yeah.
So the first year, the capacity of the tent was like 2,500. Mm-hmm. The second year, it was like 4,000. We went up by the third year when Daft Punk played, we were up, it was a fucking shed. You know what I mean? It was like walking into like fucking Amazon warehouse. We had a mixing tower that was like 60 meters high.
Wow.
I remember that's my favorite part of Glastonbury. If you want to ask me any favorite part of Glastonbury, and Daft Punk has only ever played there once.
Mm.
And I'm so proud of that. They did it under my watch. But I remember being on the highest part of the mixing tower, which is obviously always at the back of the tent where all the video and all the controls go on. For those who don't know, everything happens at the back of the tent. And we were right at the top, so we had a complete view of everything. And it was amazing. Every time the bass dropped in, mm-hmm. It was like England scoring a goal. Like the roar was just, I could actually feel the roar.
Mm.
In my stomach, 60 meters in the air over the music. It was just like the most incredible, it's the most incredible experience of my life, actually. And I'm still quite young then. I was like, 30, 28 or something.
I mean, on that point, in terms of artists and things like that, what was the reaction when you were booking people and bands and artists to be, not necessarily even in those early years, but just generally, like, were they honoured to be invited to play, or was there a bit of trepidation in terms of, like, a bit frightening to be invited to play? What did you find the response was usually?
Another interesting question. I'm a very blunt person, so I was already promoting in Bristol,
mm-hmm.
sort of dealing with bands, and some bands that had played Glastonbury, or I would perhaps book for Glastonbury. I learned quite fast the world of agencies and agents.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized that I had to make a relationship with the agents more so than the bands themselves. And when I was promoting in Bristol, I would pretty much, it'd be 50-50, like be half management, half dealing directly with the band, and the other half would be through agents. I found it quite overwhelming, to be perfectly honest. I used to make a habit of going to see all the agents, maybe in November, December, I'd sort of set aside a few days that I can be in London, and I go and see them all. And I just get bombarded with like, this is happening, this is coming up. Yeah. And to start with, it was quite overwhelming, because I realized that, oh my God, I don't know this. I don't know that.
Yeah.
And then I started feeling a little bit intimidated. This guy's running the dance tent, but he doesn't really know everything about music, or doesn't really understand what the scene is.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose at the time I started feeling like that, I had my kids growing up at the right time. So I can honestly say that certainly over the last 10 years, my children have been very much a big influence on how I have developed from dance tent to dance village, and also into Silver Haze.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when the kids were really young, I was still programming Jazz World. So going back to the Jazz World thing, when I started the dance tent, I did that for a couple of years. And then the person who was programming the Jazz World, Michael asked me if I could program the Jazz World as well. So I did that for 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I programmed the Jazz World, and also I did the dance tent, Dance Village. And then Michael said to me, you need to make a decision. Do you want the Jazz World or do you want the Dance Village?
Mm-hmm.
And I made the decision that I would go with the Dance Village because there's much more flexibility, 7 stages.
Yeah.
Yeah, just, a lower budget. And I think going back to your question as well, it soon turned out over a few years, certainly when we got into the dance tent and certainly Silver Haze,
mm-hmm.
we realized that we were breaking all the bands, not the rock bands or the, you know, the indie bands, whatever, but it was soul or it's black or it's like urban music. It was coming through the dance village first, you know, and then Silver Haze, and then, you know, and then going into like the other stage, or, you know, going up to the other stages. So I feel really proud of the fact that I think the dance tent, dance village, Silver Haze is like, yeah, it's been a transition for a lot of bands into their career.
Yeah. I mean, and Silver Haze, what from those small beginnings of just a tent, like you say, is getting bigger every time. And then into the dance village, and now into what has been renamed, I think, was it 2013? It changed into Silver Haze. I mean, that ambition for that space when it first arrived at the festival, what was the ambition for that? Was it, okay, this is a fresh sheet of paper, we're completely upgrading everything from the dance village, or was it like a natural progression?
Oh, that was very conscious. That was like, hang on, this is old. This is like, dance village. Well, let's come up with a new name. And did approach Michael about it, and we talked about it. And we came up with Silver Haze because that is actually the name of one of the fields that we look after. That's the old traditional name. They call it Silver Haze. And we didn't realize, did we come up with another name first? Can't remember now. I think we came up with another name first. It was like, no, that relates to drugs. And then we came up with Silver Haze. So I think we came up with some other name first. And it was like, oh, no, let's call it Silver Haze. So, yeah, that was Michael's choice of name. And it was great. And the funny thing about it is, like, Dan used to do all the signage throughout the whole site, assumed, and we should never assume, bless you, Dan, he wrote Haze wrong. Oh. So he did, like, sort of 200 signs with Silver Haze. I sort of remember going to him, going, like, 2 days before the gates open, going, oh, Dan, by the way, all the names are about wrong. But no, it was fine. It was good. Yeah, it's been an amazing journey at Silver Haze.
Yeah, there's so much going on there as well in terms of the breadth of genres and whatever involved, not just in kind of dance music as well. You know, you've got roots, dub, reggae, all of those kind of different flavours all being introduced as well. I mean, how important is it, do you think, to offer that diversity to a festival audience?
Really important, I think. And also, I couldn't, you know, I'm going to pay homage to a few other people as well, because I couldn't have done this on my own. You know, I've worked with some amazing people. A lot of people have worked with me personally, either at Jazz World or at Dance Tent or whatever, and gone on to, you know, run their own festivals, etc. But I think definitely when we went from Dance Village to Silver Haze, we brought in some new, you know, new programmers, you know, some fresh blood into the thing. That's when Tom and Dave from Team Love, who are really fantastic, beautiful, successful, music-loving festival organisers. Yeah, I mean, even when they came in, you know, Tom started off working in the admin, you know, on production, and slowly, you know, they worked their way through. And so I've always been, I've always wanted to, like, allow other people to be able to use me as a platform to go forward or learn, you know, that little bit of aspect in the music industry. I think I might have digressed a little bit there. So with people like Tom and Dave, and also my daughters, and my son, it wasn't just me programming Silver Haze. It was like the family.
Yeah.
I think that's why we were able to, like, put that diversity on. But, okay, they all take the piss out of me. I spent a lot of time sort of traveling around the world, going to different music events, meeting bands, you know, other countries, continents, and wanted to give them a platform as well, within the dance village and also Silver Haze. So one of the things I was quite proud of with Silver Haze is the fact that we had this world stage. So we had this, like, open air stage within the seven stages that was featuring music that you wouldn't see normally. But I've seen them, I've been there. I think diversity is really, really important. And I don't mind if people come and see something and go, oh, I didn't like that. Great. Okay. Yeah. Fine. But also, you know, there's a lot of other people who did. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So when you're programming something, I still go back to my own original gut feeling. It's like why I started promoting. I would look at a band or look at an idea and I want to put that idea on.
Yeah.
And I think that this makes me feel good. I like this. I think I can sell this to other people.
Mm-hmm.
I used to, when I was DJing, when I was young, yeah, I don't know, 16, 17, I used to organize coach trips to like Froome or Cheltenham or Gloucester.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just be the guest DJ. But I would organize like one or two coaches to come along with me.
Yeah.
So it'd be all my mates at the pub. For weeks, I'd be going, yeah, do you want to coach? Yeah. 4:30, yeah, 10 for me, don't forget, right? Okay, blah, blah, blah. You know? So I would take like 70 people with me,
mm-hmm.
and I wouldn't get paid from the club, but I'd make my money from the 50p on top of it cost me for the coach, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah.
So I got into promoting quite young, but I love it. I mean, at the end of the day, Matt, at the end of the day, there is no better feeling, whether the venue's packed or whether there's very few people there, but just looking at people and see, are they enjoying what they're seeing? And I've promoted all my life. I've probably lost as much as I made, but I think I can honestly say that I put good gigs on.
Yeah, I think as well, the overarching feeling we've had when we've spoken to other promoters is, you know, you do it for the love, you don't do it to make the money, certainly. And yeah, like you say, being able to present something to someone and seeing them enjoy it, if that gives you back the enjoyment that they're having as well, then, you know, if you can make a living out of that, then that's great, isn't it?
Yeah, and it wasn't much of a living. I mean, promoting is like gambling. It really is.
Mm.
But you gamble with your creative emotions. You know, it's like, I love this. This is brilliant. Other people should see this.
Mm.
You know, so a lot of my promotions in Bristol, I would rely on my reputation, and I introduced lots of new bands to Bristol. It wasn't about whether you knew the band. It was like, well, who was promoting it?
Mm-hmm.
You know? So the gigs I did in Bristol were all about, yeah, it was about, well, who's putting that on? Mark's putting that on. Oh, that's going to be good. I don't know this, but I'm going to come along and see it. And I'm very thankful that I think I chose good music, and mm-hmm. then I got into club night and obviously started on as well.
I mean, so yeah, you were the trailblazing tastemaker, like you say. If people are looking at, okay, well, you know, if Malcolm's chosen that or he's into that, then I know that I'm gonna enjoy that.
I suppose if you come to a few of my gigs, then you understand my style of music. Mm-hmm. So it's about, oh, well, I like the last gig he did or the one before, so maybe I'll come and check that out.
I
would work on that reputation, and then obviously I would put the obvious ones on, like, I don't know, Nitin Sawhney, Public Enemy, you know what I mean? And it's, yeah, as a promoter, it's always about being the first or getting the right band, maintain your credibility.
Is there anyone over your promoting career, you know, whether it be in Bristol or during the Glastonbury years or whatever, that you've really pursued? And well, I suppose, firstly, is there one that you've really pursued and then got across the line that you're proud of and so pleased with? And has there been another one that you've been pursuing or did pursue and it never happened for whatever reason and you kind of kick yourself over?
I think my proudest gig, and I didn't help take them across the line, but I gave them their first European gig, The Roots.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't even remember what that would be, what, 93, 4, something like that? Wow. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there was a tiny little club run by a lovely family. It used to be a supermarket, and they turned it into a club. And we built a stage. I built a stage for them, and I booked The Roots to play here at the Mallet Club, which is like 200 capacity. And they turned up in their tour bus, and I fed them at my flat, which is just around the corner. You know, it's like real sort of old school. The promoter is like, "Oh, I'll come back to mine. You know, I'll cook you some food." And so they went on stage 2 hours late. But when they went on stage, they played for like 2.5 hours. And it was just like the most amazing gig. That is like the best gig. I've seen Stevie Wonder. But to see The Roots in the Mallet, it was like history in the making. And I think after that, I probably booked them 3 or 4 times.
Mm-hmm.
After that, a couple of times in Bristol, and they played for me at Glastonbury. They headlined for me in Glastonbury when I did a hip hop day.
Mm-hmm.
They were my headline act. I remember Michael came with his family, and we sat in the pit, And I obviously in the pit, and he's going, "What are they saying?" And I said, "Well, to be honest, Michael, I can't quite understand myself." Yeah, so that was one of my proudest gigs. Mm. The other question was, Matt?
So who have you relentlessly pursued and for whatever reason it's never happened and you've always kind of kicked yourself about or anything like that? Is there anyone that springs to mind?
Too many. Lady Six. New Zealand, Maori, singer-songwriter, works with her husband, their music, lyrics, just off the scale.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there's too many. I could mention Yuma from Malaysia. Yeah, I've been collecting music all my life. I can't even get my CDs out because there's too many. And then, you know, all my computers are full up with different sorts of music. I'm never going to be able to listen to everything. Maybe when I'm sort of, you know, not able to like be compass mentors or, you know, be able to look after myself, then I'll have time to finally sit down and listen to all my music. But certainly all my vinyl has a history and a story, you know, every record pretty much I could tell you a story about it.
So I want to circle back a bit to Glastonbury and just talk generally about kind of challenges with the festival. I've been a number of times, and I've been when it's a quagmire, I've been when it's too muddy, it's too wet, or even one year where I went it was actually too hot. And people were cheering when, you know, a cloud would go over the sun. And, you know, it's crazy. But, I mean, can you think of what are the challenges for you when you're actually there and the heavens open and everything starts getting muddy? You know, what are you thinking as someone who's in charge behind the scenes?
Well, I know where you're going with this. Yeah, you're asking about this shit mud situation, aren't you? You want to hear it from the horse's mouth.
Yeah,
it was, I think it was the same year that we might have even shut the field off. No, it wasn't. That was another year. So basically, we had so much rain, and where the dance tent was, all the water was gathering at the stage. So at one time, the water got up to maybe 18 inches. And with a metallic stage and all that electrics, it was like close to 10. So we closed the tent and we brought site services in, you know, like the Glastonbury team, and we dug a well near the stage, right, the lowest point. We dug a well about 3 meter diameter with a digger. Then we were meant to bring in suckers to like suck the water out, from the well. So we bought one of the machines that would normally like pick up from the toilets. Okay, so it came in, backed up, we put the hose in, and then literally for a split of a second, maybe 4 seconds, it was on discharge instead of sucking in. So like loads of shit came out, you know, and it so happens that the council were there at the same time. They witnessed it. And to be honest, it was like, we had a digger there. We could have just dug around it, you know, but they insisted that we drain, and then we had to get like truckloads of lime to come in, and we had to disinfect them. The whole place. So that's the proper story behind, you know. But also there was a old friend of mine called Simon Glynn, who at that time was running Jazz World as coordinator. And within an hour, people were walking around with laminates saying, "Official, the dance tent is full of shit." So it's like, it was like his little pun of like, "Oh, dance music, shit." You know what I mean? So it's like, "Official, the dance tent is full of shit." And yeah, of course, the media picked up on it, and it became quite a famous story.
Yeah,
it's one of the most famous ones. But there's been loads of stories. You know, having acts turn up when it's muddy and not even, you know, insisting on driving them right to the back of the stage, and even then they won't get out because it's muddy. And so we have to come along with plastic bags, you know, or find them brand new Wellington boots, so that they can put them on inside their tour bus, it's just like, but then we've also had people who like bottle up the mud and take it home and sell it. It's like, what do you do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're working through that period as well. You know, it's during that festival weekend, how are you managing to, you know, do you enjoy yourself at any point? Is it like a 9 to 5? You're always on? You managing to see any acts? You know, how do you work through that and, you know, enjoy yourself as well?
Well, I think through Glastonbury has taught me one thing, is the art of delegation. and to be able to delegate. That did take me a long time. I remember, you know, even when I was running the dance tents and even Jazz World, I would take on so much and want to do so much. And my children accuse me of doing it now, that I always take on more than I need to, just delegate that. So it took me a while to delegate, but that it's all about the art. It is about the art of delegation. So eventually, through amazing people that I've worked with, I want to give homage to Luz Fitzpatrick, who's been working with me for many, many years as my sidekick and number two. So, you know, having the faith and the confidence in delegating that task to somebody else. So Lou would oversee everything that I do, you know what I mean? And I'd say to her, no, I'll deal with that, I'll deal with that, I'll deal with this. So she knew on the weekend, I would deal with overall production, the unique customer experience. So I would be the customer. You know what I mean? So I would go around the venues, talk to my production, but be out in the audience, see how the audience are feeling it. And so that would be my role. Lou would be dealing with the nuts and bolts of it all.
Yeah.
All the communications between the stages, security, stewarding, you know. So I knew that that was in hand, and that would all also be delegated down to other managers of the different roles and the different things that they're dealing with. So on the weekend, I would be the promoter. You know, I would go around, check on my staff, make sure everyone's happy, but also, you know, do my best to meet the agents, meet the managers, meet the occasional artists. I wasn't really ever really interested, and I don't mean this against any artist who's ever played for me. I have ultimate respect, but I'm not that kind of starstruck person. You know, that I need to go and meet the artist to feel that I've done that gig. I really appreciate what they've done, and that's why I've booked them or I've been involved with what they do. It's not important for me to meet them personally, so I won't want to impose myself on them anyway. A couple of times I do. I remember when the kids were young, I would have to. You know, dad, I want to meet this person. I want to meet that, you know, so, but not so much now.
Yeah.
I think it's more important to speak with the production crew, the agent, the manager, and 9 times out of 10, they're very grateful, thankful, and really appreciative that we've, not just me, but the team, we wanted to book that act, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To come and play Silverhaze,
And when you're booking the acts, like, you know, you're discovering all this new music, and you've already said, you know, it's very difficult to stay on top of genres, on top of all the new music that's coming out. Is there anything that you've booked or and then you've seen at the festival and like that has really surprised you and really like, wow, you know, I did not expect that, or I've never heard of these guys, but they're incredible, or what? Take me through any of those moments you can think of.
Very little, to be honest, Matt. I'm a little bit of a control freak, so I like to know what I'm putting on. So I don't think I can honestly say, well, maybe, you know, maybe a few years into Silverhaze when there's, you know, I've got like, you know, 3 or 4 programmers. Yeah, of course, I don't know everything. I remember coming across Little Dragon, which Tom and Dave booked at Team Love like many, many years ago. And just like, yeah, before that, I didn't know them. And that, you know, that was great, like, you know, electronic music. But also, you know, I've tried to introduce Tom and Dave and other people to, you know, some of the electronic music that I've been listening to, which is more worldwide. I'm always like, just want to look outside the country as well as inside the country.
And I suppose it's harking back to being that tastemaker from your promotional days as well, in terms of, you know, this is on you, this is your name, you know, up there, and, you know, people are invested in you. You don't want to be putting on things that you might not necessarily be familiar with and, you know, might tarnish that good reputation.
Yeah, but also that's also part of letting go as well, isn't it? It's like having faith in other people's taste in music and what they think should be being put on. I think like running Silverhaze has been a mixture of what's obvious that should be put on and like, what should we introduce people to? And I was quite surprised with Silver Haze, because and also with Dance Village to some extent, that people would just come and spend the whole weekend in our area and not necessarily go to the other areas, you know, unless they want to really late at night, then they go to the southeast corner. You know what I mean? But generally, they just might spend the whole day down in Silver Haze, because there was so much diversity within the area, and it's pleasant, you know, it's like easy on the eye.
Yeah, and, you know, in terms of that letting go and, you know, feeling the confidence in having that team around you that can move it on with or without you. I mean, Silver Haze is now being looked after by your two daughters, is that right? As well as the Love International guys?
Yeah, it's mainly the Love International guys.
Yeah.
And my daughters are involved with programming and development.
Yeah.
My ambition is that I will stay ambassador and I look after the backstage vibe.
Yeah. I mean, apart from that, what was your advice to them? Or I suppose, had they been involved just so much over the years that they kind of knew what they were taking on?
I really don't have any advice for them at all. Like I said, you know, we're working with Tom and Dave many years now. They're doing amazing, terrific things. They have a great team behind them, and Team Love. And my daughters are just amazing anyway. And I just hope that they, you know, they're all able to like work together and continue this amazing continuation of the Glastonbury Festival, you know, because one thing about Glastonbury Festival, if you look at all the areas, it's families, you know. Michael puts people in there who've been there for years, you know, and their children grow up there. Well, they play there, you know, they have fun there, and they volunteer, and then they become teenagers, and they, you know, they go and explore, and then they suddenly, you know, end up working and running that area in some instances. So there's no other festival like it in the world. And yeah, I think, you know, without, you know, sounding too, yeah, it's down to Michael and certainly Emily and Nick now, and the extended team up there. You know, it's a family at the farm, you know, and Glastonbury Festival reflects that in every aspect.
Yeah,
you know, when you've got 50 different areas, 50 different coordinators, production, security, you know, it's like a massive, you know, you've got the site crew, you've got the site manager, you've got, you know, people don't see the background behind what happens to make that event happen. And that's just the practical things, you know, the health and safety, making people safe, giving people an enjoyable time, giving them the services that they want. But also, there's an organic, creative, amazing team that make it happen. And I'm certainly blessed and proud to somehow have got involved with this. You know, you don't go to college. I never went to school, for God's sake. I've got no exam in my name at all. Or qualification, it was just being in the right place at the right time. And to me, it feels natural, organic, and maybe my guardian angel, male or female, is there looking after me. That's what I can say.
Yeah. And, you know, your next project, or your new project, I should say, is the Star and Garter in Bristol. From my understanding, it's quite an iconic venue in the city, right? And you've taken that on. Can you tell us like that about some of the heritage of the place and your plans for it for the future, and how has COVID disrupted that, and what, you know, how are you going to come back from that, and what kind of parties you're going to be putting on?
Yeah, it's been quite challenging. So the Star and Garter has been a pub. As much of my knowledge, it's always been West Indian run. I remember Hector, who took it over in the early 80s, and then Dirty Ken, who got nicknamed Dirty Ken, took it over in the 90s, and then the pub closed because Ken died, and I knew the family, and I'd been talking to them when he died, and then nothing really materialized, and then it came on the market, and then I bought it, and it took 2 years to buy and refurbished it, made it bigger, opened up all the rooms, so took out Ken's coffin. Well, that was gone anyway, but Ken used to have a room with a coffin in it, you know, at a table. And it was like, well, what's that all about? He's like, well, yeah, I'm going to get buried in that. And he was, you know.
Wow.
And his burial was very moving, actually. Yeah, just very moving. It's like the first time in my life I felt I'd gone to a proper West Indian burial. And yeah, it was very moving. But anyway, I knew the family, and they had lots of offers. Some were higher than what mine was, but I persuaded them that it's going to stay a West Indian pub, even though I'm only half West Indian. So they sold it to me, and yeah, so we refurbished it. I got some of my local friends, Lou Howe, Bonnie Size, Sylvia, another friend of mine, to come and help me develop and build up a pictorial history inside the pub. Yeah, and just take it to the next generation.
That's awesome. What I want to do now is move on to the five tracks on Spotify. We have something called the House Culture Perfect Playlist. Every single guest has submitted five of these tracks based on these themes to this playlist. You know, we've done like over 30 episodes and everyone's chosen five tracks. So it's, you know, it's a massive beast, you know, some real breadth of genres in there. So it's really interesting to listen. And, you know, the solid choices from you as well that you've given us.
You know them? You know the tracks?
Yeah, no, I'll tell you what. I'll tell you which ones I knew as we moved through them. There was one in particular that I knew, but I didn't know the name. We'll come to it and we'll talk about it. But we always start off with a catalyst, and you have chosen
Eddie Grant, Time Warp.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I thought they were called something like the WLH band or something like that. It was on Cactus Records, I think. Yeah, so it's Eddie Grant tune. He went on to like do Electric Avenue and I Don't Wanna Be There, you know, all that sort of stuff. But it was an instrumental, absolutely just took me away. Yeah, it's just like, wow, what is this?
Yeah, it's a mind-blowing track, like completely different from that era as well. You know, nothing else really sounded like that, I'd imagine, during that time.
It was. And for me, it was, it's kind of going back to, because at that time, I was also DJing at a club where I wasn't allowed to play my own music, only on the weekends, but only, you know, so in the week I'd have to play like chart stuff, you know, and I hated it because I was getting paid good money, but I hated it, you know what I mean? So that was one of the tunes that came along. It's like, oh my God, fucking hell, thank God, you know what I mean? As well as the Fat Bat Band and all that sort of stuff, you know? You know, it was like, wow, yeah. That's my kind of first electronica, like, wow, this is great.
Yeah, and a floor filler. I love this.
Yeah.
Tell me what it is.
I'm a disco, yeah. I love disco and I've always been a disco. Yeah, so Tavares, Heaven Must Have Sent an Angel. It is a floor filler, and you know what? You can just put that in wherever. If you want to change the genre, you want to change anything, it doesn't matter. You could be playing the most banging tune, drumming bass. You put that in, and everyone will dance. They will.
The definition, of a floor filler, And I'm thinking about the track now. I'm smiling.
Matt and listeners, if you listen to the intro, that instrumental intro, first of all, it starts off on one level, and then it takes you to a higher chord, and then it's like the vocals just come in and it's like, I'm ready. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, well, I'm ready to dance.
Cool. All right. A tearjerker. This was one that I wasn't really familiar with, but I am familiar with the band, but not this particular track.
Mate, that's all to do with my childhood, really. That's all like, it's got to be 1972, 1973 tune.
Yeah.
Twilight, Amazing Soul Band, Eugene Record, I think was the lead singer at that time. I didn't know anything about it. I was still growing up. But it was a song that touched my heart because I felt like an outsider, you know, even though I didn't really understand the song about a man's love or a boy's love for another woman. I think it's more about the lack of love that I had. So, I make no apologies. That's my tearjerker.
Yeah, homely girl, isn't it?
Anything from the Shy Lights and the Stylistics and Teddy Pendergrass and that kind of soul, you know, that comes from the soul.
Yeah, proper soul music. Yeah, and a last tune. This was the one that...
You missed that one, The Sunset.
Oh, sorry, The Sunset. Yeah, no, I have. Sorry, you're right. My God. Thanks for picking up on that. Yeah, no, the Sunsetter.
It's a no-brainer, isn't it? It's Cool and the Gang, Summer Madness. You know, whether it's the live version, the extended version, the single version, whatever version, that is the ultimate. It ends with a ring. It ends with a ring in your ear that's not too piercing, but even when the track is stopped, the ring just continues for a little while. It's just an amazing song. It's an amazing song.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the last one.
Yeah, last one. This was the one that I've heard a million times. I never knew. Yeah, I've heard it, you know, you hear it in the background of things, don't you, in adverts and stuff like that.
Or, you never knew what it was.
I never knew, yeah, what it was. And then when I listened to it before this, it just brought this huge grin onto my face.
Right, okay, I'll tell you a little story behind this tune and why it's my favourite. Is that it's not just my end of tune, but it's also, if I'm following a DJ at a club, you know, I would just put this tune on. Could I just take everybody away from whatever they were fucking listening to? It's like, wow, we're going to rewind, start again.
Yeah.
So this particular tune was in the charts in 1960. Okay. I was born in 1960. So in some way, in my subconsciousness, I was brought up with this tune because it was popular music. Yeah. And literally when I was 40, I was at Electric Picnic. We were setting up the Pussy Parlor. I had a whole team of crew and friends with me, and they brought me a card, and they brought me this 1960 hits from the 1960s, number one hits from the 1960s. And I remember the festival wasn't even open, but I remember like just whacking the CD on, you know, because we had the sound system on and everything. And it was like the third or fourth song on. I was walking across and I just stopped in my track. I was like, oh my God, I've loved this all my life. And I don't know why. What the fuck is it? Do you know what I mean? And that's it ever since. For the last 20 years, I think. Yeah, 20 years. I have been playing that song as my last tune. If I'm doing a set or if I'm following on from somebody else to get everybody's attention. And normally what happens, Matt, at the end of the night, whatever happens, they all start waltzing or they all try to waltz. It's fucking hilarious. It's absolutely hilarious. So that is the story behind my last tune.
Yeah, what tell us what it is, who it is and what it's called.
Oh, sorry, it's Percy Faith Orchestra and it's called Theme from a Summer's Place. Yeah, I love kids music as well.
To have that, like you say, it's like a palate cleanser. If you're following someone and you put that on, that's like, okay, I'm reset now.
Yeah, that's my reset tune, last tune. And no one ever comes up and complains. Yeah, you just see 15 or 200, 300, 400 people suddenly go from like banging that disco tune or that, even that drum and bass, and you just stick that on as the last one. And then they all start waltzing.
Fantastic.
A lovely way to finish the night, because it's a lovely tune. It's like, just lovely, beautiful.
Yeah. Everyone floats home.
Yeah.
Brilliant. We always finish with one final question to really wrap it up, is that, you know, we are house culture and we're interested in all kind of club culture, music culture across the broad spectrum of everything. And we always ask our guests who exist within this culture and have made it their life, you know, when you look back on it and try and sum it up, what would you say that it's brought you overall, the culture in terms of music that you've dedicated your life towards?
Kept me young. It's kept me young. I think so. There's a lot of people my age wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. But yeah, my love of music just keeps me young.
Perfect. That's a brilliant place to end, and a great final thought, I think. So let's stop there.
All right, Matt. See you later.
House culture.
What a guy. What a life. There were some incredible stories in there, right? Everything from Daft Punk, diva-like demands, and a dance tent full of dung. You can certainly experience all of the rich variety of life at Glastonbury. I want to say a massive thanks to Malcolm and his family for making that conversation happen. It was a joy to sit down with him and hear his story. I also hope that it satisfied some of your hunger for the festival experience that we're all missing out on at the moment. We shall be returning to live music in Muddyfield soon. Whilst we're waiting for that to happen, you can bring the party home with the House Culture Perfect playlist on Spotify. As you heard, Malcolm submitted some inspired choices to the Perfect playlist. Some much needed kitsch in the form of Percy Faith's theme from A Summer's Place, all the way through to the beauty of Homely Girl by the Chilites. Unfortunately, Eddie Grant's 1970s proto-minimal track Time Warp is not on Spotify, so make sure you check that out elsewhere. Meanwhile, you can indulge in all of the other selections by opening up Spotify and searching for House Culture Perfect Playlist. Whilst listening to that, please help support this podcast by loving, liking, tweeting, sharing, and rating or reviewing us on Apple. We love hearing from you. And if you say something nice, it will not only help us to continue to create these podcast episodes, it could also get you a shout out on a future one as well. This time around, I'm shouting out to Adam Sandel. He got in touch on Facebook to say that he listened to our chat with lovely Laura and he really enjoyed it. Well, Adam, let's hope you also enjoy flicking through our back catalogue and getting amongst our previous podcast guests as well. And if you want to join us at House Culture from wherever you might be in the world right now, please hit up our Instagram feed at HouseCultureNet or follow the hashtag TrueHouseCulture. Not only will you be kept fully informed about the podcast, you'll also get connected with other beat lovers from across the globe. And finally, if you want to get in touch with me, Matt Rouse, you can do it directly on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and see you next time.
House Culture.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.